Exploring how we can transform our communities in the 21st century with the support of St Ives Chambers, RHE Global and Me Learning. Welcome. This is the Community Safety Podcast with your host, Jim Nixon.
Welcome to the Community Safety Podcast, the podcast that will explore how we can transform communities in the 21st century. Today, we turn our attention to antisocial behaviour within the UK. My guest has over 15 years tackling antisocial behaviour in a wide range of roles, and we will look at the current situation in the country today and also look at how we can improve and change things for the better in the 21st century. Take a snippet from today's episode.
Domestic abuse in young girls is, for me, the starting point really of destroying any confidence that they have at that point. And how do you turn that around as they become an adult, you know, as they become a young woman, from an early teenager having been controlled and instructed to do certain things and be told how to dress, how to talk, when to talk, when to interrupt, when not to interrupt, how to live your life, to live in that fear. How do you then, when that young girl turns into womanhood, try and unravel the abuse so that they become a confident young woman who lives without fear, who is able to make decisions and is confident in those decisions?
It's now time for the Community Safety Podcast.
Welcome to the Community Safety Podcast. I'm your host, Jim Nixon. I've been working in community safety for over 25 years. This podcast will explore how we can transform communities in the 21st century. Today's amazing guest is Tracy Jones. Tracy has over 15 years experience working within antisocial behaviour and community safety services. She worked for Manchester City Council as well as Wigan Council. Tracy has successfully managed different teams within both a local authority and social housing context, including the management of frontline ASB services, ASB enforcement case management service. Tracy now works in the learning and development industry as a digital learning consultant for Me Learning Limited, one of our sponsors, actually, proving digital learning solutions to many public sector clients. Welcome, Tracy. Thanks so much for coming on the Community Safety Podcast. It's absolutely brilliant to have you on board.
Thanks for having me, Jim.
Tracy, obviously we're both involved in the same sort of profession, really, antisocial behaviour. So it's really fantastic to have somebody from the ASB world that we can sort of have a good chat about antisocial behaviour and sort of explore other things as well today around community safety. One of the things I was quite interested in with yourself was you grew up in Manchester, in Salford. What was that like for you growing up as a teenager in that sort of area?
At the time, it is what it is. You know, you don't see it as being anything different. It's a way of life. But looking back, I think when you reflect on the world that you were in and the type of people that you were around, then it does hit you, actually. Just the type of area that you were living in. So for me, Salford is quite a prominent and well-known place. It's known for its gangland rivalries. It's known for crime. It's part of Manchester. Excuse me. And for me, as a teenager, I was surrounded by people who were either part of a gang or whose brothers or sisters were in a gang, and it wasn't tough for me because I grew up in Salford. You know, it was my home. I went to school with friends and family, and it wasn't tough in the sense that I found it tough living in Salford. It was just, it's a way of life and it's a culture, and it's very difficult to understand unless you live in it and unless you have been there. But looking back now, I can see that culture is still very much prominent in Salford, Manchester, and in many inner cities across the UK.
Yeah, it's quite interesting actually that I've had a couple of guests on already, and in particular Paul Wormsley, who I interviewed the other day, who grew up in Liverpool, and he was saying similar to what you've just said really. It was just like the norm, you know, it's what he knew. I suppose you grow up in that sort of environment and it's all you know. What was crime and antisocial behaviour like during that period for you? Did you see much of it about?
All the time, Jim, all the time. There were regularly police cars, police vans, riot vans, screaming through the streets. It wasn't unusual to hear them every night. In fact, it would be unusual not to hear them. I was a teenager. I was out and about in the streets. I was one of the good girls, you'd be pleased to know. But it wasn't uncommon to see, you know, a group of youths who I knew from school coming out of an alleyway, or word on the street was that somebody had just robbed a factory or somebody had just pelted the police vans. It's a very, very strange thing when you look back and to try and describe it now, but crime and antisocial behaviour back then was very much as it is now.
One of the things that I was looking at was, how did you avoid getting involved in that sort of gang culture? Because I think it's so important to understand that girls do get dragged into that kind of culture, and we see it sort of, you know, today we've sort of county lines and all the sort of issues that we're seeing today in sort of 21st century Britain. What would you say were the things that you did right so that you avoided those kind of temptations, I suppose?
First of all, it has to be strong parenting from my mum and my dad, obviously. That's the first thing. Secondly, I had a group of friends who were like-minded. We wasn't swayed by the criminals that were on the streets. Some girls saw it as being, you know, a celebrity status, for want of a better phrase, to be with a criminal or a head, as they were known in Salford or Manchester. That's what they call them, heads or heads of families. So it was seen as some kind of celebrity status to have a boyfriend who was a known criminal. For me and my friends, it was never appealing at all. My passion when I was 13, 14, was to join the police force. And as there were often police vans on the estate, either pulled up or, you know, just roaming around the estate looking for criminals or trying to find the local criminals, they'd often be parked up and I would always approach them and have a conversation with them. You know, what's it like to be a police officer? I really want to be a police officer. And I would get seen having those conversations by the local criminals, obviously. And they'd be shouting things like grass and, you know, and I'd just tell them to shut up. It didn't intimidate me in the sense that other residents were intimidated, because I think because I'd grown up there all my life, for me, I knew what the boundaries were and I didn't feel that I wasn't able to tell them to be quiet, you know, stop calling me that name, because it wasn't coming from a place that they were intending me harm. It was sometimes quite mocking and humoristic as well. But just to make a point, it was very, just to be very clear as well, there's a common theme, isn't there? And even now amongst residents in all our communities, if you're seen speaking to the police, you are instantly seen as a grass. It's a terrible word, absolutely terrible word. But for me, back then, I'd just shrug it off because I know that they knew I wasn't speaking to the police about anything because I didn't know anything, because I didn't, you know, roam in their circles. But it was interesting in terms of being moved away from that or not being attracted to it. And I think for me, as I said earlier, Jim, very strong parenting, very like-minded friends and principles and values, I think, and seeing as well what had happened or what was happening to friends or people that I knew from school, and just having the sensibility and that sense of pride in myself to think, that's not for me.
That's such an interesting way of looking at it, really. One of the key things that you said there is around strong parenting. And I think when I've said this on a couple of interviews now, that when you start looking at some of the kids that we're seeing in today's sort of Britain that are involved in drugs, involved in knife crime, violence, when you start to dig deep into their backgrounds, and I don't want to make excuses for them, because we have to be mindful that there are victims, in any crime that they're committing. But I think when you do dig back into their backgrounds, there is a lack, I think, in a lot of cases of that parenting. And they haven't got a clear direction. They haven't got clear role models. And I think that's one of the main reasons why we start to see the sort of issues that we're experiencing today. What are your views on that?
I absolutely agree with that, Jim. I myself experienced as a young child, I say young child, I'd say probably more so a teenager, watching school friends who could be out and about till whatever time they wanted. You know, I had a strict curfew. I had to be in at 9 o'clock. And if I was 1 minute late, I was grounded for 2 days. You know, whereas some people would come into school the next day and they'd talk about how they'd been, you know, roaming in at 1 o'clock in the morning. They were going to nightclubs. They were sitting in people's houses, in drug dens, and they'd brag about it in school. And it was obvious who those people were. And looking back now, it's scandalous, really, how those kids weren't picked up and how they were left to slip through the nets. And I think your point about looking back and delving deeper into the background of lots of people who are now engaged in criminality or ASB, whether they are adults or young teenagers now, there is a lot to be said about where they came from and what their childhood was like and what boundaries they were set, if any. So I completely agree with what you've said.
You obviously mentioned earlier about some, you know, of your friends or girls that you were aware of obviously being attracted to, you know, the players as such within that sort of area of Salford. How, from your knowledge, and I'm not expecting to go into any great detail, Tracy, but from your knowledge, how were those young women treated?
Very poorly, in most cases. They were seen as being owned by their boyfriends, for want of a better word. Looking on the outside in, you could see straight away that those girls, they had no voice. They had, and I shouldn't really make a blanket view here, because that wasn't always the case, but generally they were owned by the gang. They were told to wear certain clothes or not to wear certain clothes. If there was a breakup, despite the fact that that girl was no longer with that boy, she would be instructed not to have another boyfriend. I was aware of a number of girls actually who did just that and found boyfriends further down the line, and then they were assaulted. They had the head shaved off, and that was a symbol really to the rest of the community. This is what happens if you don't do as you're told. We own you, and everybody will know it. You must not disrespect me. And that again is a culture that, when you're on the outside of that, it's very difficult to understand, and it's very difficult to even begin to comprehend how these girls can be treated like that. But as you grow up in an area like that, it is the norm. But having that ability to stand back and realise that, actually, no, this is not the life for me, and I will not be dragged into that kind of world. It's also easy to see how very easily girls can be drawn in as well as boys. And I think there's a lot to be said for interventions and youth projects that work really, really hard across the UK to try and intervene at a very, very early stage with young girls and young boys, trying to prevent them from getting involved with the wrong people. But it's so difficult. It is so difficult.
I think from what you're saying there as well, reading between the lines, domestic abuse obviously was a massive factor in the way that those girls were treated. And it's just horrendous to see this kind of stuff, like you say, already, you know, still going on to this day. But again, what I would say is that it's a sense of belonging, isn't it? When you, again, look and delve deep into that young person's background, if they're not getting the support and the love that they are, you know, yearning, then I think it's only natural that they then will gravitate towards somebody who initially shows them that love and support, and they get sucked into a false sense of security. They then become, you know, they believe that they're in love with that individual, and then before they know it, they are then the victim. And it's I think it's a pattern that we're seeing time and time again, isn't it?
It is, and you're right, Jim. Unfortunately, these girls who are drawn into these relationships, we all know how vulnerable they are, and it is around that need to be loved, that need for attention. And it also explains why some girls in their early teens are very sexually active as well, which again is a reason why they are out there and they are vulnerable and they are prime for the predators, so to speak. But domestic abuse in young girls is, for me, the starting point really of destroying any confidence that they have at that point. And how do you turn that around as they become an adult, you know, as they become a young woman, from an early teenager having been controlled and instructed to do certain things and be told how to dress, how to talk, when to talk, when to interrupt, when not to interrupt, how to live your life, to live in that fear. How do you then, when that young girl turns into womanhood, try and unravel the abuse so that they become a confident young woman who lives without fear, who is able to make decisions and is confident in those decisions in moving forward in life without blaming herself or feeling guilty? It's a very, very difficult area again, isn't it, domestic abuse? But again, in the work that I've done in antisocial behaviour, so many cases involved domestic abuse, both from a woman's perspective and a male perspective.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. When I worked in housing, we dealt with a massive amount of domestic abuse. In fact, I'd say it was probably a large proportion of our casework at one point. You touched very nicely there on antisocial behaviour, and what I was going to ask you was, what attracted you to working in that field? Because it's a tough field. We were talking just before we switched on the record, and I think it's something that people probably don't always understand if they're on the outside. But it's a tough gig, so I was just very interested to see what attracted you to that type of work.
I like the term, it's a tough gig, because that is absolutely spot on, that, Jim. Well, as I said earlier, I was always passionate about joining the police force in my early teens. But that was cut short through, believe it or not, a trip to the optometrist when I was looking at having contact lenses, and I was explaining to the lady who was taking my eye test that I wanted to be in the police force, and she shook her head, and she's, I think I was 16 at the time, and she said, oh no, she said, not with your eyesight. And that was it. I just naively and automatically assumed that was me, gone out of the police force, never to return again. I've not even got in. But yeah, and I think I was always fascinated with the police, crime, that type of thing. And I worked at Salford Magistrates. I worked in the criminal justice world. I worked for a criminal solicitors where I was involved in lots of defence work. I worked very closely with criminal barristers. I was integral in the casework in terms of casework for criminal trials. I was absolutely enthralled by the work, and I loved being in court with the whole criminal justice side of things and seeing how it worked, seeing how the process went. And I think there was a specific time during that point in my career when I was dealing with a certain defendant, and it was a case that had came in. And he'd been arrested and he was being held in the cells. And one of the partners gave me the statement and said, I need you to go over to the cells. It's in the magistrate's court. And I was reading the statement, and the statement was from a young victim, a young female victim. And she'd been horrifically raped by the defendant. And there were things in that statement which were particularly horrendous. And as I walked over to the magistrate's court, I'm normally quite resilient. It was the type of work that I was in. Of course, you deal with sexual cases all the time, amongst many others. But there was something about this particular case that really, really struck a chord with me. And I went down into the cells and I spoke to the defendant, and he had no remorse whatsoever. And I remember looking at him, being in this cell with this defendant, and thinking to myself, this isn't for me. This isn't what I want to do. I don't want to listen to his excuses. I don't want to hear how he's dismissing the victim, calling her names. And I think that was a turning point for me. And that's when I started to look at the wider remit of crime and what careers were out there. And then I came across a position at Manchester Council in the antisocial behaviour team. And as soon as I read the advert, it struck a chord with me. And I thought, yeah. And that the first line of the advertisement said, "Are you passionate about supporting victims and communities?" And that was me.
So it was that sort of pull. That was the pull, the support of communities. I was going to ask you, did you, at that time, did you read, because it was, I'm not saying that antisocial behaviour hasn't been around for many years, because it has, but I think it's only really in recent years it's really come to the forefront, really. Back then, in sort of 2002, when you sort of started to work for Manchester Council, did you really understand what ASB was at that time?
No. To me, ASB was neighbour nuisance. In fact, the ASB team was called the neighbour nuisance team. And interestingly, neighbour nuisance has this whole new frame to it, doesn't it? When you say antisocial behaviour and you say neighbour nuisance, I would say the majority of people would picture two very different things. So when I started working in the world of ASB, the term was neighbour nuisance. And I didn't really understand what that meant. I made the assumptions that it was neighbours arguing over the fence. You know, neighbours squabbling over, you know, parking spaces, parking disputes, that type of thing. But clearly once I started to delve deeper and receive some cases and work on some cases, it was very clear to me that neighbour nuisance wasn't just neighbour nuisance. There was a whole new world out there.
It's quite interesting you saying that, because when I joined the police in 1995, I can remember going to quite a number of antisocial behaviour cases that you wouldn't see them back then as those kind of cases. The term, it's quite funny actually, the term that our controllers used to use, if you say it was kids causing problems in the street or whatever, it would be yobs yobbing. Can you go and do another yobs yobbing job? And it's quite embarrassing when I look back to think of how we tackled antisocial behaviour back then. You know, you'd literally turn up as a police officer on patrol. You'd shoo them off. You wouldn't take any names. You wouldn't take any details. And you know what's going to happen, Tracy. 5 minutes later, these kids are going to be back and they're going to be causing problems again. And it was probably the same in neighbour disputes as well. You know, the way that we used to deal with them back in the 90s and probably the early 2000s was not the best, really. And that sort of leads me on to my next question. I was going to say, you know, working in the council back then, how well do you think that you, and this isn't a criticism, I was just interested to know, how well do you think you tackled ASB back then?
I would say, working for Manchester Council, that because it was a leading ASB service, it was tackled very well. But I do take your point, Jim, in that how it was tackled nationally was very challenging. There would be a lot to be said for how organisations across the UK, whether that's police forces, housing associations, local authorities, struggled to tackle ASB, or neighbour nuisance as it was called back then. And for me, Manchester was a beacon, wasn't it? It was a leading service, and we had very strong senior management. Bill Pitt, for example, he championed witnesses. He did a lot of work lobbying the Home Office for lots of the legislative powers that were given to councils and housing associations and police forces. So I think for me, completely take your point in terms of how, looking back then, certain cases were dealt with. But even in Manchester, you know, in the time that I was there, over the 13 years, I could see how strategies changed. You know, youth nuisance cases, as you've just said there, in the early days, it may have been that the police came along and didn't really take names, and the neighbour nuisance team didn't really deal with the youth cases like they do now, or they did subsequently, because it wasn't as much of an issue then. But it's grown, hasn't it? And it's grown into something that's quite a phenomenon, really. And it's interesting when you talk about the term ASB. I'm still baffled now that some people still think the term ASB means a gang of yobs. And that's it. Whereas you know, and I know, that you could have a caseload of ASB cases and a small majority of those will be youths who are the perpetrators. And the majority of those cases will be adults with very complex issues, drug and alcohol dependencies, mental health issues, domestic abuse. You know, a case could have a single complex issue or a range of those complex issues.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I sort of obviously manage casework day to day in my sort of day job, and the amount of complex issues now that we see, you know, like you've just reeled off, you know, mental health, drugs, abuse. It's such a complex kind of subject, and you're so right. It's so wide. And I do think even to this day, people just think of ASB as just kids causing problems. And it was far more complex. And I think it's great that we're able to talk about it today on this podcast, because it's really important that we get that message across, really, just how complex and how difficult it is. In fact, you may remember there was a guy that was an ex-ASB officer. I think his name's Nick Pettigrew. And he wrote a book about it last year, about ASB officers and what they face. And to our listeners, if you haven't given it a read, you want to give that book a read, because it really does epitomise the sort of the daily role of an ASB officer, and how difficult that role is, and how, you know, I think he's on record of saying, you know, it had a massive impact on his mental health, which was one of the reasons why he moved away from ASB. One of the key things to ASB, Tracy, in my experience, is partnership working. You know, it's key to everything that we do, you know, working with the police, working with other key partners. When you obviously started on your sort of journey 2002 and sort of and beyond, how did you find partnership working in Manchester? Was it good? Could it have been improved?
In the early days, it was fairly good. There was a lot to be improved. And I'm thankful to say that through the work that I myself did with other managers and senior managers, we really strengthened partnerships and relationships. As you said, Jim, you know, partnership working, it's the key to successfully tackling ASB in the communities in any area. And it's essential, isn't it, really, that agencies are able to collaborate, not just collaborate, but effectively collaborate. We use this term, don't we? Partnership working, multi-agency working, collaboration. But how do we collaborate? How do we work effectively with partners? How do we build those relationships? And for me, a key point, really, in terms of partnership and multi-agency working is information sharing, as we all know. But it's also about maximising resources. We're there to deliver shared outcomes. And if you've got agencies that are rubbing up against each other or coming into conflict, that's just time and energy wasted, and victims are suffering, you know, as a result, really. So for me, the early days were fairly challenging. You probably know yourself, Jim, you know, how many times have you been in a multi-agency meeting? You've got different agencies around the table. There's sometimes, and I suspect it still happens now, there will be instances where one agency thinks another agency should be dealing with a particular case, and that agency thinks that another agency should be dealing with that particular case. And it's about establishing the ground rules, really, isn't it? But once you've established those ground rules, and once you've established those relationships, and you've got those partnership protocols in place, and agencies are working towards them on a day-to-day basis, then the work of an ASB officer and, you know, the managers and everybody around them is wide open. It just opens up that world of help, support, assistance, and that then in turn enables the witness to be fully supported. If partners are working together in the right way, you know, collaboratively, effectively, and they're being open and honest, and they're having those candid conversations, and they're being proactive in the partnership world, then ultimately the cases will be resolved much more quickly and much more effectively. And that's all that any ASB practitioner wants, I would have thought.
We're just going to take a very short break to hear a quick advertisement from our sponsor, Me Learning.
Have you struggled to find consistent training for your antisocial behaviour team? MeLearning's new ASB digital training programme follows the journey of managing an ASB case from start to finish. It's clear, consistent, and cost-effective. And it leaves all ASB professionals confident to take on their cases effectively. To find out more, you can visit www.melearning.co.uk to get started today.
Yeah, one of the big things I talk about is, and I actually picked up on this, I'd always kind of applied this, but I never really thought of it in this way. But I went to a meeting just before Christmas and somebody said, we've really cracked our partnership work, you know, we've done some great work, but you know how we've done it, we've left our egos at the door. And I thought that was absolutely fantastic. And it's kind of exactly what you're saying there, really, is that if you're going to get good, effective partnership work, you've really got to leave those egos at the door and you've got to all start work together. And one of the things that I've started to do a lot with my partnership work is I got very frustrated with the amount of partnership meetings that I was going to where they were like crammed with, you know, lots and lots of people around the table. And you'd be like doing like a what they call a task to finish meeting. And what I was finding was that people didn't want to really be in the meetings in some instances. And it was always a few selective people that were doing a lot of work. So one of the things that I've started to do is to make my meetings a lot smaller with the key people around the table. And what we're finding is we're getting such much better results because we're more focused. We've all got a common purpose, a common goal. And our results are really starting to speak for themselves. And the other thing that I think is really important as well is not to have that task to finish. Is to, in certain areas, you know, you talk an area like, you know, like Salford where you grew up, you're never going to have a task to finish in an area like that, are you? You're going to be task to task to task to task. And I think sometimes there's a big error made when people go into an area, they throw a load of resources out, they all walk away when it's successful, you know, when they get a few successes, and then we're back to square one in a very, very short period of time. So I think, you know, that's a lesson that people need to learn, really, is that keep the pressure on even when it goes quiet. What would you say your views are on that, Trace?
Yeah, I completely agree with that, Jim. In terms of the partnership working and the task to finish mentality, I experienced so much of that in my early years. I've been an ASB officer, I've been an ASB manager, and people were actually turning up to these meetings, these partnership meetings, feeling like they had another load of work to come to. You know, they've left the office with a whole host of tasks to do, a whole host of new ASB cases to get their head into, existing cases, court deadlines. And then they're walking into a multi-agency meeting expecting a whole new load of tasks and actions that have been set from somebody else. It's not great for relationships, so I completely take your point on that. But for me, I think partnership working, more recently for me, when I was previously at Wigan, I found that the police there were on the ball, they really were. They were really proactive. You know, officers would come into the office with evidence already around a potential case. So it was very well established. And I think that talks volumes, really, for relationships and also for officers who, bearing in mind the lack of resources that police officers have at the moment on the ground, and, you know, they keep cutting and cutting and cutting, it speaks volumes, really, about their passion and their drive as well as police officers on the ground, but also their relationships with the housing, with the local authority, and around understanding that each other has a real resource to share, and that lives would be made so much easier, professional lives made so much easier, if we all work together and we don't just sit and wait for somebody to ask for some information. We are being proactive and we are thinking about partners, and we are also thinking about how can we engage partners more effectively so that they do want to attend particular meetings. And like you said, Jim, you know, keeping them focused, keeping them targeted, keeping them relevant, and making everybody's voice being heard as well, and not being that person who says, you know, my view is this and my view is that. It's around collaboration, and that's what I was saying earlier around not just collaborating or being seen to be collaborating, but effectively collaborating, you know, sharing those ideas, sharing those objectives, and really sharing those strategies and how those strategies play in an area based on the ground, real time, real work, and being really effective in terms of those particular communities that need them.
Yeah, and it's like a false economy as well, Tracy, when you think about it. You know, if you keep going around the reeking with a particular case because you can't get partners to come on board, you think of the amount of money in those resources that's wasted, and actually you've got the right people around the table in the first instance, everybody's got a common purpose, the amount of money that sort of saves. And I don't think sometimes that is ever really thought of, really. You know, you'll have a massive partnership meeting, and sometimes I've sat in those meetings and I've like looked around the room and I thought, how much has this cost, this meeting? And you know, that's not a criticism at all, but it is a point. And I just think that we have got to look at better ways of doing things. And I think from what you've said today, and I certainly think in Stoke where I work, we're starting to get things right and we're starting to move forward and we're starting to see some real differences. And again, hopefully, if people can sort of pick up on stuff from this conversation and improve their partnership working, then that, you know, for me, that can only be a good thing. One of the things I was going to ask you about was, in your career as an ASB officer, what was probably the best case that you ever sort of was involved with and got a really positive result? I'm sure there's lots, Tracy, but there's always one that sticks out in your mind.
That's a really tough question, Jim. Ooh. There are two, actually, that stick out in my mind, but if I had to choose... the one that stood out in my mind, it would have to be it was a female perpetrator, actually. And this is a great example of demonstrating to the police how effective civil powers really are in terms of tackling quite serious ASB. This was a case where a particular tenant was causing all kinds of problems in the community. She was intimidating residents. She was having parties every weekend, smashing bottles, loud music till 5-6 in the morning, people drunken outside a house, throwing up, you know, that kind of thing, urinating on the streets. And if anybody asked for the music to be turned down, they'd get a load of abuse. And this had been going on for quite some time. I came in and looked at this case and was really, I mean, I'm not going to say where it was because I dealt with a number of cases over a variety of social housing councils in over my time as an ASB officer, as a manager. But it was quite concerning the length of time that this had been going on. But what was really, really obvious to me was that this particular perpetrator was intimidating the ASB officers, and she was running rings round the department. It was very obvious. She would take quite much pleasure in ringing up and twisting and spinning people round and round and round in a conversation. She was very, very intelligent, very intelligent. So I took this case on and obviously relished the thought of resolving it. And residents were at the point where they were moving out. People had already moved out. There were a number of residents that were actually looking at moving out. There'd been homophobic abuse, there'd been threats, there'd been windows smashed, there'd been assaults by using pets. It was very, very serious. And this perpetrator felt that she was running the show, for want of a better phrase. But what was most prominent is that throughout this time, throughout all these reports, and there were hundreds of reports, not once had she received a face-to-face warning. Not once had there been considered any ex parte action, despite the fact that there were several reports of threats and violence. So, without going into the detail of the case, because it's a very, very long case, I took the view that this was very, very serious and it needed serious action. Looking at it from a practitioner point of view, it was a case of having to start again, because there wasn't a there wasn't a strategy in place for the case. It hadn't gone down a particular route and stopped, or there was just no strategy in place whatsoever. It was all over the place. So what I decided to do straight away was get this person in, have a conversation. Meanwhile, speak to the police. The police knew this perpetrator. She was well known to the police, and this particular police officer was actually thankful that somebody was willing to come along and tackle her. And I remember him saying to me, this police officer, just be warned, she's one of a kind. And I said, so am I. And it was quite interesting, really, because I took on this case with every intention of resolving it for the residents and for bringing peace and for bringing that calm and quiet back to the community, which all of those residents deserved. And it was a long slog, Jim, don't get me wrong, in terms of the court process. We got an injunction. That injunction was breached on numerous occasions. So when I say it was a long slog, it was a long slog because she continually breached and breached and breached, to the point that she threatened me, she threatened my family, she threatened to slit my throat and that of my children. And she received a custodial sentence. In fact, she received three custodial sentences. The first was a 3-month, the second was a 6-month, and the third was an 8-month sentence. And the reason why that case was, or why that stands out to me particularly, is because what it shows is that when you give a perpetrator that sense of power and that sense of dominance, and then suddenly some kind, you know, an enforcement action is taken against them, they still resist, they still push those boundaries, they continue to push those boundaries. And when you mentioned earlier, Jim, about the money that's spent just in multi-agency meetings, well, the money that was spent in this particular case was astronomical. And some may argue, could there have been a better way of dealing with it? You know, well, yes, you know, early intervention, some more intervention strategies in terms of drug and alcohol issues that we established that this perpetrator had, mental health issues that this perpetrator had. And don't get me wrong, we had exhausted all of those avenues. And the barrister who dealt with the case was very, very complimentary of the work that we'd done. But what that case did for me was it proved that no matter how much a perpetrator will resist, will threaten, will push those boundaries, will keep fighting back, in the end, if you stick with it and you fight for your complainants and you champion your community and you champion your residents and you keep those witnesses on board, then that perpetrator does realise that there is a boundary. There are boundaries for their behaviour. There is a line that has to be drawn. They have to respect their community, and we will take action. So, yeah, I think that has to be the case that stands out to me, because what that also proved was, in terms of the courts, the outcome in the courts, and I know that lots of people don't agree with custodial sentences, and for me it is a last resort, but in this case it was well justified and it was well needed. And when she came out of prison the third and final time, we actually excluded her from the area anyway, so she moved out of the area. But interestingly, she part of that case involved her being very manipulative over a vulnerable adult, and again that was picked up through the case. Now, had that case not come to my attention, and had I not delved into the case and developed it and, you know, got it into court and really got into the intricacies of the case, we would never have known that, and we couldn't have protected that person. But through the case, we was able to protect this vulnerable person and stop the abuse, in terms of the money abuse and the financial abuse that the perpetrator was doing to this poor woman. So yeah, a very interesting case, a very mentally draining case, a very exhausting case, but a very refreshing and satisfying case as well. It was for everybody involved, from the solicitor to the barristers to the defence team to the judges, to the judge in the court. It's a case that I think will probably stick with all of those people for a very, very long time. And without going into detail, there were some very interesting things that happened in court, in the courtroom, that were comical, I think, to say, for want of a better word. It's a very interesting world, isn't it, ASB? And people look at it and say, you know, how many cases have you dealt with and what types of cases do you normally deal with? Well, you know, how long's a piece of string? And just when you think you've dealt with every single case possible, along comes another type of case that you could never have even dreamed of having dealt with or having been responsible for managing.
I really love that. And the reason I say that, Tracy, is because when I was a police officer and also in the work that I do today, I absolutely love it when somebody says to me, and then come back to what that police officer said to you, you know, you're going to find this really tough, you know, and people have tried before and they haven't succeeded. You know, it's like red rag to a bull to me.
Yeah.
And to, you know, I just think about the impact that work that you did there would have had on that community. It would have been absolutely massive. And I know the work that I've done in the past when I've got positive results with people that are in the really hard to do basket, it transforms communities. And again, this is what this podcast is all about, really. It's about pushing the boundaries and doing stuff that sometimes people are very frightened of, but it does make a massive difference to those communities. And that story that you've just given us there, that account, just signifies it all for me in that respect.
Yeah, and I think as well, when you share those experiences with fellow practitioners and they listen to the challenges that you faced and they resonate with it, I think what it does as well, it is inspires those practitioners to be brave and be bold and be challenging and really, you know, make those decisions and not be frightened to take action or legal action when it's needed. And I think that a lot of practitioners are scared of taking legal action for many reasons, Jim. But I think, you know, I've heard case experiences from my predecessors and they've inspired me. And I think that, you know, what you're doing now with the community podcast is sharing experiences from a wide range of different people. And it can only serve to inspire and enhance the world of ASB and to show people that, you know, don't give up with a case, keep going. There are people out there, there are practitioners out there who understand what you're going through and the challenges that you face on a day-to-day basis. And there are perpetrators who will drain you, they will mentally challenge you, they will physically challenge you, and they will make you feel that they will never stop. But you've got your legislation behind you, you've got your organisation behind you, you've got your fellow practitioners and your teammates, but most of all, you are champion. You are the champion for your witnesses. You are the voice for your complainants. And that's what always keeps me going, or kept me going as a practitioner, was listening to the fear and the worry in a complainant's voice and having that satisfaction to say to them, we'll deal with it. I will get you through this and I will make sure that you have your quality of life back again. And the amount of times, I'm sure you've had this, Jim, where they've sat there and, you know, they've shook their head and they said, people have tried, or this particular person won't back down. And having that phone call or having that face-to-face discussion in court and saying, we got the injunction, or, you know, we've dealt with the breach. It doesn't just stop at the injunction. Of course it doesn't. But, we've, you know, preparing your witnesses for what might come is key to making sure that witnesses stay on board. And the minute you can say to your witness, we did it, how do you feel? And they say, I'm so relieved. And you see the relief on the face and the tears pouring out and the emotion that they've held up for years and years in some cases. That to me is not just satisfaction in terms of job satisfaction. That is something that it really humbles me. And it's something that I'd probably never go tired of. And I'm not in the world of ASB at the moment in terms of practitioner work, but I'm having conversations with so many wonderful people in the ASB world, and they are fighting such a difficult fight at the moment with COVID and trying to manage cases and keep complainants supported. I really do salute them all, because it's such a tough job without a pandemic, without restrictions in place. So I really do salute all the ASB practitioners out there, whether it's police officers, housing officers or council officers and beyond, you know, the British Transport Police. There's so many fantastic organisations out there doing great things and people don't realise how much work they're doing.
Yeah, and like you say, you know, one of the things that I just picked up on there, you were talking about, you know, talking to practitioners and helping practitioners around the country. One of the things that I've been trying to do over the last sort of 12 months and beyond, really, is reaching out to a number of ASB practitioners. And I'm by no means an expert. I haven't got all the answers. But I do think it's really important that we reach out to people. And I've been really happy to help quite a number of practitioners over the last few months and get immense pleasure from it. And we've built up quite a nice network now, and I'm sure there'll be a few of them listening, you know, to this podcast today. But again, the message I want to get across to, you know, practitioners out there, reach out. You know, there's a lot of us that will help and will support you. And if you've got a difficult case, give us a call, you know, and talk to us about it. We'll definitely help you. And the more we spread best practice, the better that ASP investigation is going to be. This has been a really great conversation. Tracy, tell me about your work now with Me Learning. I'd be really interested to, and I'm sure the audience would be interested to, just hear a little bit about what you're doing now.
I'm currently with Me Learning as a learning consultant. So what we do is we provide digital learning to lots of councils and public sector organisations across the UK. More recently, Jim, you'd be pleased to hear, as I'm sure you know all about it by now, and if you don't, where have you been? I've been integral in developing a full suite of antisocial behaviour, best practice casework, digital training. And whilst I have been heading that up for some time, I am also involved in other areas of digital learning, which is predominantly in the social care sector. But I am very much invested in learning and development. I think training is key for practitioners. ASB, whether it's ASB, whether it's social care, whether it's any organisation, for me, quality training, you know, when somebody comes in and they're in an induction process, whether they've been at an organisation for a number of years, training is the key for anybody, whether they want to develop the skills, whether they want to learn new skills, and keeping up to date with existing trends and existing legislation and understanding case law. But for me, training has to be at the forefront of every employer's mind and every employee's mind, really. So for us at Me Learning, the great thing that I love about it is there are so many different people that I work with and so many different organisations, really, that are reaching out to us in terms of digital learning.
Training is so important. When I took on my team in Stoke, you know, they desperately needed some retraining, and the results have just been amazing. You know, we brought in a fantastic trainer and did some work over a number of months, changed policies, changed procedures. But I'm so proud of that team in terms of what they've achieved over the last couple of years. And you've got to say at the forefront of all that is the quality training that they received. So absolutely, you know, and again, the message that, you know, get across to any practitioners that are listening today is keep up to date with the training, keep refreshing people's knowledge and giving them new skills, because it will make your service so much better. Tracy, is there any question that you wanted me to ask today that I haven't asked you?
No, Jim, I think you've grilled me good.
Oh, thanks, Tracy. It's been an absolute pleasure having you on board today. I think we've had a really good chat about ASB, and I hope the audience, you know, can take something away from our conversation today and have a little bit more of an insight into the ASB world if they don't sort of work in that arena. Can't thank you enough. How can people reach you, Tracy?
If people want to discuss any type of training with me, they can contact me on my email address. It's tracy.jones@melearning.co.uk. That's melearning.co.uk.
Oh, that's fantastic. And I'm sure you'll be inundated after this podcast. So thank you so much again for listening. Thank you to Tracy for coming on today as our guest. Please like, rate and subscribe to the Community Safety Podcast. We really want to get our mission across to as many people as possible. So please tell friends, colleagues, to get involved. We want you to be very much a part of this. We want to hear from you. There's also the website, which is www.thecommunitysafetypodcast.co.uk. Please reach out. We want to hear from you. We want to hear about your ideas. And hopefully we'll see you with the next episode. Thanks for listening. That was a really interesting interview with Tracy Jones, talking about all things antisocial behaviour. it was really good to sort of get some background as well in terms of her days growing up in Manchester and how she sort of steered away from the gangs and some of the criminality that was going on and still goes on to this day. And also we sort of explored partnership working, which is so important to tackling antisocial behaviour. We also highlighted how important good quality training is to all ASB practitioners if we are to win the fight against antisocial behaviour in the 21st century. And there will be more guests coming on board during the length of this podcast who will share their experience as well around this important subject. Thank you for listening to today's episode. It really is appreciated. Please spread the word if you like the content. It's so important that we spread the message across the whole of the country and further afield. Please rate, like, subscribe. And also don't forget there's the website as well, which is www.thecommunitysafetypodcast.co.uk. Thank you so much for being part of this really important project.
You've been listening to the Community Safety Podcast. With thanks for support from St Ives Chambers, RHE Global and Me Learning. Join us again next time to help us explore how we can transform our communities in the 21st century. On the Community Safety Podcast with Jim Nixon.